I'm very glad we have here today with us Mr. Adnan Mazrai. He's a well-known name in Pakistan, having led the mission to Pakistan from the IMF. He is well-known in the fund because he has been a very senior fund official, IMF official, and he has worked on many countries, but I think from our point of view, his crowning glory was working on Pakistan. He did two programs for Pakistan, I think. He's had a long career in the fund. So today we're going to discuss with him two or three issues. One issue is his engagement with Pakistan. What does he learn from it? What advice will he give Pakistan on moving into a durable stabilization where we can say goodbye to the fund, where we can get out of the emergency ward? Two, we'll ask him about his views on development, macroeconomics, and the IMF, since he's had such a long, distinguished career there. By the way, I should also mention that Adnan now is a senior fellow at the Peterson International Institute, which is a very famous institute that I think everybody's aware of. So, without further ado, let me pose the first question to Adnan. Adnan, you worked in Pakistan, and my audience is Pakistani students, and Pakistani, I guess, whoever, economists are interested in it. Can you please tell us, we've had probably 20 or 21 or something programs with Pakistan, IMF programs with Pakistan, and Pakistan has just got into another program. Will this ever end? And if it will end, how will it end? Who is better placed than you to answer this question?
Thank you very much, Nadeem. It is pleasure to speak with you. You are right, one of the highlights of my professional life at the fund was working on Pakistan, both intellectually and also closely, working close to home for me.
Which I mentioned, Adnan is from Iran.
Right. So I almost felt at home being in Pakistan. As you said yourself, Pakistan has had numerous programs with IMF. The number we should keep in mind is 21. I repeat, 21. Those are the number of programs the Pakistan has had with the fund. What does this tell us? This repeated engagement with the fund tells me that Pakistan keeps going through cycles of policies and outcomes that lead to some unfortunate outcomes that forces Pakistan to come to the IMF. And then something's reforms are done. The IMF and others provide liquidity support to help with balance of payments and fiscal difficulties. Then the IMF leaves. And then after a while, the cycle repeats itself. When a cycle repeats itself so regularly, it means the Pakistani economy is not just going through shocks from outside. Every economy goes through shocks. They adjust to it. Sometimes the fund gets involved, sometimes it doesn't. But the regularity tells us there's something inherent to the political economic system in Pakistan that creates this situation. Every few years, one realizes growth has been kept up, somewhat artificially maybe, by expansionary fiscal policies. One then realizes the deficits are high. They are financed either from the international community or from the domestic banking system. Tax revenues are low. exchange rate is kept artificially stable or fixed. Considerable amounts of international reserves are spent defending the rate. And then those reserves go down. There is a fear of a balance of payments crisis. Pakistan and goes to the international community, especially the IMF and the World Bank. And then this cycle repeats itself. The question then becomes, what are the inherent features of the Pakistani political economy that contributes to this repeated cycles? As in all other countries, issues of economic policy have to be studied within the governance framework of that economy. Pakistan has an economy which tries to have a sizable role of the state. And I'm saying try because it's not clear how successful and how productive that effort is. There is a large sector of public enterprises that rely in one form or another on unhelpful interventions by the state. There is a tax system that is very complicated, often involving arbitrary exemptions, and also the tax system doesn't enjoy considerable legitimacy in the eyes of the people, particularly because the people in general, that's my impression, don't feel the burden of taxation is borne equitably. Secondly, it is not clear to them how well the resources collected through taxation are spent. Okay. Everywhere taxation systems should enjoy a degree of legitimacy based on those two considerations. Another feature of the economy I've always felt has been the prevalence of rent seeking. The economy has been the management of the economy is overly centralized in the hands of the government. Regulations are put in place, sometimes feel in the interest of the bureaucracy rather than of the economy and those who produce value, be it the workers, be it the entrepreneurs. There are lack of clarity and competition between the role of the central government and the provinces, which increasingly shows itself up in fiscal issues, who gets what resources and who spends money on types of activities such as health and education. I've also felt that part of the situation is due to over-reliance on Pakistan's geopolitical importance and the sense that outsiders, for one reason or another, will come in and support Pakistan financially. Of course, Pakistan has been and remains a very, very important country geopolitically. But geopolitical importance, geopolitical weight changes over time. Things happen on the global stage that change a country's geopolitical importance. For example, the United States has become rather independent of oil imports from the Middle East. Therefore, inevitably the geopolitical importance of the Middle East to the United States is going down.
Okay.
With the end of the Cold War, with the situation in Afghanistan, let us say, being what it is, the geopolitical weight of Pakistan also changes. And in this new configuration, I'm afraid Pakistan may not be able to be rely on as much of the financial and economic goodwill of the international community and various countries as it used to.
But now let me ask you. Now, I think you pulled a very nice overview of the picture in Pakistan, mm-hmm. and I agree with you wholeheartedly. Our issue is that there are so many underlying problems that we have to deal with. For example, as you said, the question of governance, the question of taxation, the question of spending. As you said, they're tied in. Mm-hmm. If people don't feel legitimacy of taxation, they're not willing to provide taxes. People don't see the money is being spent on them. They don't want. So the question of social contract. The second, the most important thing that you also said was that it's also important the role of the public sector. What is the public sector doing? I mean, is it controlling, providing goods? Is it controlling resources? What is it doing? So all these things are very important. And when these things pile up, they lead to a balance of payments crisis. And that's where the fund is called in. But very briefly, how is the fund sought to address these issues over 21 programs? Because the question that legitimately Pakistanis ask is, and as you know, a common friend, Ashfaq, has been raising a hue and cry that we shouldn't go into a fund program. I don't mean to take his name, but there's a lobby out there that mm-hmm. says don't go into a fund mm-hmm. program. Mm-hmm. So the question is, has the fund program adequately addressed these things? Is the fund incapable of addressing these things?
The fund is at its best when it addresses short-term macroeconomic imbalances. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Through provision of liquidity and sometimes, mm-hmm. I should say, usually on some financial controls over spending and changes in exchange rates or other variables that help contain a balance of payments crisis. Mm-hmm. Those issues are the fund where it is at its best. The fund also tries to advise, put as its as conditionality, issues that are called structural reforms. Okay, structural reforms. The fund is not the best and most successful in addressing. First of all, those are the deep parameters of a country's political economic structure. The fund is naturally not the most knowledgeable about those compared with the local authorities. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And those issues go into the DNA of the political and the economic structure of a country. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even if the fund knew what are the best structural reforms to make, mm-hmm. and I'm not saying we in the fund, when I was in the fund, knew always what those were. Mm. That is really under the control of that country itself. Mm. Mm. It depends on a country's own strategy, vision of where it wants to be, and its narrative.
Okay.
So if you are in a short-term macroeconomic problem, the fund can come and help. Mm-hmm. On issues of long-term growth, mm-hmm. on issues of long-term institutional change, mm-hmm. those are more under the control of that country. Mm-hmm. And of course, when the short-term problems are brought under control, mm-hmm. the weight of the fund in influencing those decisions goes down. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's another issue that I think we should take up, which is also very important and has been discussed, as you know, in Pakistan. You're right that the fund is not a short-term balance of payments management agency and not necessarily in charge of longer-term issues. But the approach that the fund takes and the way you described it also, mm-hmm.
and I've also worked in the fund, so I know. The approach is we are looking at the balance of payments crisis through the lens of the fiscal problem, and we are focused on the fiscal problem, and we are trying to solve the fiscal problem, and obviously growth escapes our attention.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent is it that the fact that we can't solve the long-term structural problem, but we are rushed to solve the short-term problems, then it does it set up a dynamic where long-term growth declines? And this is what people are talking about is austerity in the West. I know Pakistanis don't think austerity is a problem, and our finance minister also claims austerity is a good thing. But you know, austerity has received a lot of criticism. The issue is, are we, because of the fund's emphasis on short-term fiscal problems, getting into an austerity situation, killing the long-term growth? I might also add, there is a lot of evidence to show that productivity has been declining in Pakistan over these years.
Mm-hmm. You raise the critical issue, that countries that go through adjustment programs
mm-hmm.
need to address. Mm-hmm. And that is growth.
Mm-hmm.
Those issues are also income distribution,
mm-hmm.
sustainability of a strategy.
Mm.
Those issues are sometimes unavoidably not the most important focus of a program with the IMF that is first and foremost trying to avoid a balance of payments crisis today. And the instruments for those usually apply to fiscal policy and monetary policy. Structural reforms that lead to growth are much more complicated, and we, including in the fund, have to be much more humble about, first of all, knowing what are the prerequisites for growth. We have some understanding. But you're absolutely right. Whatever is done, growth in the Pakistani economy has been going down. Productivity growth has not been adequate. Institutions are rigid. The incentive system is such that people try to find returns through navigating regulations rather than saying we want to, let's say, export. We want to be producing goods and services that the rest of the world wants. This doesn't necessarily mean you take all of the state out of the economic sphere. For example, in East Asia, China, other places, the states have played an important role. But there has been a sense that, at least for much of their recent history, that they have to produce for the outside. The incentive systems, I'm not saying they're all market determined, but need to be geared toward focus of economic activity on production rather than on rent seeking.
Okay?
Those issues are the deep parameters of a country, and the fund and others who have to, by nature of their job, focus on short-term issues will never be able to address adequately.
Let me ask you a couple of technical questions. For example, do you think that the fund, and let's keep Pakistan in the loop, but more broadly, do you think the fund is too hawkish on inflation? My view is, for example, on Pakistan, I think we are a bit hawkish on inflation. We tend to think that Pakistan's optimal target rate of inflation should be about 4 or 5%.
Mm-hmm.
My view, 10% is not that bad. Second thing is that you've seen countries like Turkey, for example, have had a high rate of inflation and yet have grown faster.
Mm-hmm.
China at times is overheated and has grown faster.
Mm-hmm.
So to what extent does this view, hawkish view of inflation that we have, kind of constrain our growth? Inflation is very important, but one should not be, of course, dogmatic or excessively focused on this. It is true that inflation that is out of control and highly variable distorts economic systems. It is true that it contributes significantly to poverty and income distribution problems. But you're absolutely right. There shouldn't be an overemphasis on fiscal targets. There shouldn't be an overemphasis on excessively low rate of inflation. I think there was, in general, what is you said has been, you know, not an invalid criticism of the fund in the past. In the recent crisis in Europe, especially, there has been greater recognition that fiscal austerity is not suitable for growth, and especially in the context of Europe and the advanced economies. My former colleague in the IMF and my current colleague in Peterson Institute, Olivier Blanchard, has been writing excessively that debt is not good, but the cost of debt should not be exaggerated. Okay? Therefore, you are right. Excessive rigidity on fiscal targets, excessive focus on budget deficits, without consideration of what it does to growth, be it in terms of aggregate demand or long-term supply issues, makes a big difference. For example, if there are good projects for building infrastructure, which will inevitably help growth in many countries, those should be done. And to the extent that financing is available, those should be undertaken.
Well, now let me raise another question, which is very important. There's a strong feeling in Pakistan, and this is a question that you might choose to answer diplomatically, but fine, we should get your answer on this. That is a strong feeling in Pakistan that the fund comes in with a cookie cutter approach and forces conditionality down the country's throat. But at the same time, the fund insists, and rightly so, and I can see it on the other side, that, hey guys, there's an urgency to do a program, and we want you to come up with a program which is basically a set of policies to get out of your mess. And as we discussed just now, it's straightforward economics. It's not politics, but it's a question of getting your accounts in order and getting your house in order. And you can have a program with long-term growth, and you can have, provided the numbers add up and provided the sums work out, and I both know how to do it, and lots of people in Pakistan know how to do it too. So the question is, to what extent have programs rammed down countries' throats? Leave Pakistan out of this. Let's talk more generally. And to what extent are countries prepared to write their own program and take advantage of the negotiation? And to what extent do countries really seriously negotiate this program with an intent to implementing it? Or is this just a game being played, game of chicken being played between the fund and the countries? So the countries can drive the fund up to a point where they can take advantage of it and not do the reform.
Look, somebody who worked in the IMF for 25 years, I may not be the most objective person to answer this question. But perhaps I can rely on my own experience working on Pakistan. I became the mission chief in Pakistan in 2009. And others may disagree, but my colleagues and I went to Pakistan with a mindset to look at various options available to deal with the short-run issues and hopefully contribute to some changes in economic strategy that would have brought more long-term growth. When I took over, I remember there was an issue of budget problems. Of course, you inevitably, the control of the budget is one of the things that you go after if you are facing a short-term balance of payments crisis. But there are many different ways to go about it. There are issues of what expenditures to adjust, what to cut, what to actually ask to be raised, for example, on safety nets. What kind of revenues to raise, be it income taxes, taxes on consumption, and how to finance those budgets. First and foremost, the counterparts that I had in Pakistan were all highly intelligent, well-trained economists. Some, the best and the brightest of the international financial institutions, trained in the best of the world, world universities. So there wasn't a question of lack of an understanding of frameworks or etc. Absolutely not. And certainly they knew their country better than I or my colleagues did. The problem was many of the things that could have been done, maybe needed to have been done, are not politically feasible. Of course, the authorities know that the best, and they tell you what can and cannot be done. Let me give you a case of taxation. I remember discussing with my counterparts whether income taxes could be raised. There were indications that that would be very difficult to do in the short term. I asked about taxation of agriculture, which was by and large outside the control of the federal government. It was indicated to us that those are not in the purview of the authorities. We were negotiating a program with. Then we agreed that maybe a better way to go about it was a value-added tax. Okay. A value-added tax is very complicated to explain to people in many ways, and also not easy to prepare for and put in place. Efforts were made by the authorities. And I think in many ways, some made very good faith efforts. But at the end of the day, the value-added tax was not put in place, partly for political considerations, partly because of how those would have affected different provinces, different services. So, unfortunately, by default, controlling the macroeconomy became more a function of touching spending that may have had a difficult implication for growth. For
example, austerity.
For example, development spending.
Yep.
Right? We always used to joke that the development spending is the line of the first attack in the country, not just in Pakistan, but in a lot of other countries, right? Energy subsidies, etc., were deemed politically difficult. Not that they weren't done, but they were not done adequately. But development spending often becomes the first victim of adjustment. And naturally, that did not have a good impact on growth.
That leads to us.
And that leads to a lot of unfortunate circumstances.
So now let me draw you now, sort of telescope out, and draw you to where you and I began our careers.
Mm-hmm.
with a kind of a desire to develop our countries, with a kind of a desire to make good things happen in the world. So just go back to that idealistic past and think about it. What would be your advice to, let's say, countries like Pakistan or the Middle East? You work on the Middle East, for example, or your country, Iran. Let's say if you were called in to be the finance minister of Iran, well, there were various things different in Iran. Let's not go into the politics of Iran. What would you suggest as a way forward to develop the country, to make the country grow? As I said, going back to your idealistic past, what is your advice? What should these countries do? Let's draw back from the fund. What is it that the country authorities should be doing?
Okay. First and foremost, and of course, I'm not saying I had these insights the first day I arrived at the fund, but this is the
what you've learned through
decades of experience in this. You have to, as a country, have a strategy. A strategy does not necessarily mean a very tightly controlled agency for mapping the future of a country sector by sector, price by price.
Like the planning commission.
Like a planning commission. Rather, one has to recognize that eventually a country's success will depend on the ability of producers and consumers to act in a rather decentralized way in response to simple incentives, but with good governance. Good governance means a set of regulations that keeps economic activity playing field level for people. One that prevents the rise of rent seeking. One that prevents one group of the elite, one form or another, and the elites of different countries come from different places through different historical processes, taking over and determining the incentive system and economic policy for themselves. For example, it is good to subsidize education. Education in Pakistan and other places is the easiest way to raise productivity, and sustained productivity increase is the pillar of economic growth and development. But education needs to be a service that is available to the entire population, not to the children of the elite. And those subsidies should not be falling on the back of those who can't afford it to benefit the more affluent. You need a system where you recognize one way or another you're part of a global economy. Reasonable people can, of course, disagree on how globalized the world economy should be. But overall, the welfare and the economic performance of countries is in good part determined by what they produce and sell abroad. Of course, that's not the only place they can sell domestically too. But historically, for most smaller countries especially, their performance has been judged on what they produce and sell abroad. Okay? But I want to go back to the governance. Governance is the most fundamental issue. And by that I mean a framework that allows the people to rule themselves without excessive hierarchies, without a rigid, siloed government that determines everything and all for various people. And this means some regulatory reform. This means, especially in this day and age, the use of technology. For example, there are elements of the digital economy that can make government activities like spending, who bids for what project, what the government spends for its procurement, the way it raises revenues. And these, using digital information, using the information developments, be put on the web. Okay. So greater transparency. And also, there has to be a sense that countries, while they're members of the global community, they need to be self-reliant in the sense that nothing comes from the outside comes for free. Over-reliance on the international institutions and their bilateral friends to come in and help them creates a sense of moral hazard, if you wish, laziness, and bad incentives, where then a lot of the elites take chances with bad policies in their own interest. But when it goes wrong, the population is left to pay for it.
That's a very good point. I think that's a very good point. The fact that the existence of foreign the markets and the foreign lending and foreign institutions like the IMF and the World Bank also distort incentives at home. And mm-hmm. I think we have to bear that in mind. So I think those all those points are well taken. So finally, Adnan, let me also ask you, I think a question that's uppermost on Pakistani students' minds, I guess, or young economists. What has your career like been in the IMF? Have you enjoyed it? Has it been worthwhile? Would you rather that Iran had been open and that you had gone back to your own country and served there? Have you felt like an exile, or do you feel that this was worthwhile? By exile, I mean, remember the famous Edward Said thing where he felt that he lived outside, but it was an exile. So the question is kind of reflection, not only in your career and your outside, but as an expatriate, how valuable is working at home?
Felt extremely lucky to have worked at the fund. While not every moment, not every day is fantastic, but generally I to this day cannot believe I had for 25 years the privilege of working there, not necessarily for the institution alone, but for countries. And of course many people disagree that the IMF did or does what it should do for countries. But I felt we did. I learned a tremendous amount. I worked with great colleagues from all over the world and faced both policy and operational issues on various countries. And to this day, if I had to do it again, I honestly don't know if I could have chosen a better career. Naturally, the IMF, like others, works in the political, international political framework and international governance framework. Not everything about that is desirable or good. There are days when those are frustrating, but in the real world, those frameworks are there. Of course, I would have liked to be able to go back home to Iran and work there at some point. Circumstances haven't allowed that. I have, for earlier in my career, where I was more free to, did some research on Iran, and since I've come to Peterson, I've been doing more of that work. I've recently done some work on Iran's banking crisis. Naturally, a frustration is that I have not been back for a few years, but there is information available. There is good research being done in Iran. while I don't like everything and a lot of things I should say about Iran's political and social circumstances, many of the issues that I and many Iranian expats are interested in are discussed in Iran, are researched and debated. Debated in the media, debated in parliament, believe it or not. For example, the Iranian parliament has a pretty okay research section, and in the social media. Okay? It is extremely frustrating to not be able to be there. It is frustrating at many times to watch how the economy is being managed and many other aspects of the country. So while I haven't lived in Iran for many decades, it's still part of my general interest and perhaps still the number one issue of my both professional and other interests.
Thank you, Adnan. This is a great interview, but let me also thank you on behalf of Pakistan. Lots of our colleagues appreciate what you did there. And you've got a lot of good friends there who still talk about you very fondly, because as all of us feel that you really put your heart into it and your brain into it, and you really wanted to help the country. But as you said, these problems are abstruse, very complicated. Human dynamics are very difficult for us to understand. We only deal with the economic realm, but there is a huge dimension beyond the economic realm. So wonderful seeing you again, Adnan.
Thank you very much, Adi. Privileged to have worked on Pakistan, and good to have worked with you and to see you today.